A teacher is a leader. A mother is a leader. A child is a leader because they're leading themselves. And so how do you teach people how to be a great leader of themselves so that they can lead other people?
Welcome to The One You Feed. Throughout time, great thinkers have recognized the importance of the thoughts we have. Quotes like garbage in, garbage out, or you are what you think ring true. And yet, for many of us, our thoughts don't strengthen or empower us. We tend toward negativity, self-pity, jealousy, or fear. We see what we don't have instead of what we do. We think things that hold us back and dampen our spirit. But it's not just about thinking. Our actions matter. It takes conscious, consistent, and creative effort to make a life worth living. This podcast is about how other people keep themselves moving in the right direction, how they feed their good wolf.
Whether this is her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct is everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Thanks for joining us. Our guest on this episode is Michael Brody Waite. Michael is a recovering addict, acclaimed speaker, entrepreneur, award-winning three-time CEO, leadership coach, and author. Today, Michael and Eric discuss his book, Great Leaders Think Like Drug Addicts, How to Lead Like Your Life Depends on It.
Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, man.
It's a pleasure to have you on. We're going to discuss your book, Great Leaders Live Like Drug Addicts, How to Lead Like Your Life Depends on It. And I'm excited to talk about that because your and I's background and stories, there's a lot in common between us. But before we get into the book, we'll start like we always do with the parable. There's a grandfather who's talking with his granddaughter, and he says, in life, there are two wolves inside of us that are always at battle. One is a good wolf, which represents things like kindness and bravery and love. And the other is a bad wolf, which represents things like greed and hatred and fear. And the granddaughter stops. She thinks about it for a second. She looks up at her grandfather. And she says, well, grandfather, which one wins? And the grandfather says, the one you feed. So I'd like to start off by asking you what that parable means to you in your life and in the work that you do.
So first of all, what it means to me is that me being on here right now is meant to be because I used that parable in my first keynote that I ever delivered as a paid gig to carry my message before I ever wrote the book. And I always think about, when I think about that parable as a recovering addict, the difference between the disease of addiction and recovery from addiction. Every day I have the opportunity to feed my disease, the thing that kept me using, and every day I get the opportunity to feed my recovery. And that may not be totally new to folks that are familiar with recovery and addiction, but it also reminds me of the environment that I found in the corporate world and in the startup world, where my observation was people were almost addicted to hiding their true selves, and they were addicted to managing other people's perceptions. And so when I ended up in the working world, I was being told that I had to literally stop feeding my addiction. And so it became meaningful to me both in my personal life and in my professional life, where I was being told in a 12-step meeting, take your mask off, be your true self or whatever. And then I'm going to a corporate world and it almost wants to reinforce what the disease of addiction did. And so even though I would go to my meeting and I would feed the good wolf for 1 hour out of a day, I would go to work and I would spend 8 to 10 hours in an environment that wanted to feed the bad wolf. And so every day I had to be really intentional in which one that I fed because I did not want the bad wolf to live.
Yeah, I love that. I figured the parable would be one that you know well, because that's, of course, where I heard it in recovery. I can't pinpoint the meeting or the time, but I know when I heard it, I was like, oh my God, right? Because I heard it in my first year, I'm sure in my first probably 6 months of recovery. And as I often jokingly say on this show, like, I wasn't even feeding the bad wolf anymore. He was eating me.
Oh, yeah, that's a great way of saying it.
It was just a very clear message to me about what you just said. Either I'm getting better or I'm getting worse, you know, and the choices that I make about what I do with my time, my energy, my thoughts are going to dictate, you know, do I recover or not? There was a clarity to that that I found really helpful.
I think there's also an interesting element where we always think, at least I do, about all these decisions and moments in our lives as these like big movie moments. And so when I thought about like calling my sponsor, for example, I thought of, you know, the desperate moment where I'm about to use and suddenly I call him and he saves the day. And the thing that he explained to me was the only way that call happens is if I call him every single day when nothing's happening for like 3 weeks. Because I have to have the muscle memory. So that way, when the crap does hit the fan and I don't know what to do, it's a default behavior. And that gives me the ability, right, to surprise myself in the really big moment. But it's all these little moments. And same thing, actually, if you really want to geek out around nutrition, right? Like, you know, that people think about working out, the physical fitness, you know, lifting a lot of weight. A lot of physical fitness is around what you eat. And so the little things that you eat, it's not like the big fast. And so there's just so many applications for this parable that I love. And I just love this platform as a result of it.
Yeah. I can't remember why or where I was telling this story, but I was talking about that if you looked at the movie version of my life, you'd see these big moments, like the moment that I was in detox and they said, you need to go to long-term treatment. And I said, no. And then I went back to my room and I had a moment of clarity and I thought, I'm going to die if I go out there. And so I changed my mind. That would show up in the movie, right?
Yep.
But that moment is not really any more important than the thousands of other completely unremarkable moments where I made the small decisions that kept me on my road to recovery. It's just we pull out these certain moments. We go, this moment's really important. This moment's really special. But all those moments together are what equal recovery. It's the really boring, ordinary moments.
I think they have that saying in show business too, right? Like an overnight sensation only took 10 years to build.
Yeah. Yep.
Same thing.
Yep. Same thing in the startup world, right?
Yes, very much so.
Yep. So before we get too much further in the book is titled, as I said, Great Leaders Live Like Drug Addicts. I love the parallel you've made there. But what I want to do first is not everybody listening to this show thinks of themselves as a leader. So I want to bring leadership to everybody's level before we go further so that everybody can kind of relate with this conversation, whether they're in corporate America or not. So let's talk about the ways in which we're all leaders.
So I think everybody is responsible for leading somebody, even if it's just leading yourself. And I think we're almost always wrong in the level of importance that we have. We either always assume that we're too important or not important enough. But when you look at it through the lens of who's watching, there's always somebody in your world that's watching you, looking for a cue on how to behave and how to do the right thing and not do the wrong thing and so on and so forth. And so for me, I think early on, the best example of a leader that I was ever given was a sponsor in the 12-step program. And as I became a leadership coach and all these things, I started to really appreciate the difference, because when we think of leaders, I think we think of these command and control style leaders, the general on the battlefield, the corporate CEO that knows everything and doesn't do anything wrong. And or we just think about somebody that's responsible for leading other people, period. But like a teacher is a leader, a mother is a leader, a child is a leader because they're leading themselves. And so how do you teach people how to be a great leader of themselves so that they can lead other people? And what I love about a sponsor is, unlike a coach or an expert or even a mentor, the way that they lead you is by showing you how they lead themselves. They don't tell you, I have it all figured out. They literally share their experience and they share their vulnerability and they share their challenges, and they just say, this is what I did. And they do not try to manage your perception in any way. And by talking about how they led themselves through X situation, like I'll never forget my sponsor telling me about the first 6 months he had in recovery, he had a sponsor that at month six killed himself. Huh. And he was rudderless. And so I thought immediately in my head, I would relapse and I would go back out, because if my sponsor was trying to help keep me clean and then he killed himself and it turned out he'd been drinking the whole time, I'd say this whole thing is screwed. But what Chuck did was he said, I went back into the meeting and I found another sponsor. And so he's not telling me a pretty scenario, right? He's telling me an ugly scenario. But in that, I take a cue for what do I do? And then believe it or not, 6 years later, he's no longer my sponsor and I'm sponsorless and I need to get a sponsor and I don't go out. I don't do all this other stuff. I go into a meeting and I ask for one because he shared his experience. He showed me how he led himself so that I can more effectively lead myself. And I think in that vein, every parent, every teacher, every volunteer, whether you're in the boardroom, the mailroom, the classroom, or the living room, you are leading someone, even if it's just the person in the mirror.
In the book, you say the problem is we've become so focused on leading others, we've fundamentally lost the ability to lead ourselves.
Yeah, I forgot that line. You just said it better. So is it weird or awkward that I'm complimenting you for reciting my line?
Well, it just is. So we all have a role to lead people or lead ourselves. So let's talk about this fundamental thing that you see here, that you're in recovery and you see some of the things we do in recovery, and then you go into your corporate world and you see people doing that thing. And you refer to that as what you're seeing that all these other people are doing is they're wearing masks. Say a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So when I was in rehab, one of the first things they did, and this is well before a pandemic and anything else, they slapped two cardboard masks down on the table and they said, we want you to doctor one up to look like the person that you portray to the world. And we want you to make the other one look like the person that you think you are. And so, of course, like the one I show the world has like George Clooney. I'm probably dating myself by saying George Clooney, but it has celebrities and BMWs and all this like great stuff and toned abs and, you know, whatever it is that you want. And then the bad mask is me trying to reimagine that advertisement where it shows someone running and it says, no one ever says I want to be a junkie when I grow up. And that's who I actually think I am. And so that really helped me because it gave me a very physical context where I could think about when I'm hiding my true self and how addiction to drugs is a way of hiding my true self. So one of the parallels that I draw is when I was in active addiction, there were three things that I did on a regular basis. The first thing was I said yes when I should say no. I said yes to the drugs. The second thing I did was I hid my weakness, my addiction. And as a result, I starved myself of the solutions to help me get better. And then the third thing that I did was I avoided difficult conversations. Anything that was going to lead to a reconciliation of my addiction, I was going to avoid. And so when I went into the corporate world, being armed with a 12-step program, a sponsor, and trying to unlearn these behaviors, my observation was, and I've since confirmed it with a lot of research, is that all the people around me were doing the exact same things that I did in active addiction. So I said yes to drugs. They were saying yes to meetings. They were saying yes to emails. They were saying yes to projects that they all thought was unnecessary. Like 31 hours a month right now are spent by employees on what they believe are unnecessary meetings. If the definition of addiction is doing something over and over again, despite a negative consequence, that to me is the picture of addiction. And so another example is hiding a weakness. So I was hiding my addiction. Well, I remember once when I was working at a Fortune 50 company, I spent 22 hours trying to figure out how to use a Microsoft Excel pivot table when I could have spent 10 minutes asking someone and admitting that I didn't know how to do it. And that's leading yourself, right? I could have upped my skill level to be more productive. And I was wasting so much time trying to save face in a corporate environment. And at night, I'm going to a 12-step meeting where the coolest kid in the room is the person that shares their biggest challenge. And then they get a ton of help. And so it just didn't jive. And so then the third thing is avoiding difficult conversations. Man, you want to talk about learning how to do that? Work some 12 steps, like learn how to do amends, right? Like those types of things are really hard. And for people that don't understand that, that's like when we go and we actually own all of our bad stuff that we did. And so when I was in corporate America, they would talk around issues in a team meeting. Everybody would be just managing politics. And I found a stat that 70% of employees right now are avoiding a difficult conversation with their boss, coworker, or a direct report. And that's before you start talking about customers or whatever. So at night, I'm going to a 12-step meeting and they're saying, basically, you have to be your true self or you're going to die. I'm going into the corporate world where everybody's teaching me hide your true self in order to be successful. And I felt very, very alone. And it was not because I was in Nashville, Tennessee, and I had long hair and said dude a lot and was from California and had flip-flops and hoop earrings in my ear. It was because I was saying no to things. I was having the difficult conversations and I aggressively shared my weaknesses. And it scared people and it made me feel alone and it made me feel different and also got me promoted like 8 times in 8 years.
Yeah, it's interesting because I have some similar experiences. When I got sober, I got sort of into the corporate slash startup world. You know, I had always worked in restaurants before, and I think I got some of the opportunities and had some of the successes I had for some of the very reasons you're describing. You know, I just was kind of who I was. I just showed up and I just would say, I don't have any idea how to do this.
Which you have to do to survive, right? But
yeah.
But so many people, that's like the hardest thing for them to do, period.
Totally, yeah. So I think as you name those three things, I'm like, yeah, I think I kind of did those things. You know, I noticed over the years, I've talked about this on the show many times. I don't think I've talked about it recently, but I talked about how authenticity is sort of a buzzword these days. But the more I was myself at work, and I went through periods of being very radically who I was, and then I would sort of go through periods of like, well, I'm going to try and cover it up. And I'm, you know, sort of like you said, I'm getting a lot of reinforcement to not be that way. But I think even through it all, I managed to remain somewhat who I was. And what I realized was the more I did that, the more I took those chances to be who I was actually at work, the better I always was at my job.
And the thing is that these are like what people would call soft skills, but they have hard outcomes and impacts. So Harvard Business Review says that the number one resource that's poorly managed inside of organizations today is time. Mm-hmm. And I've assessed over 2,000 leaders at companies like Google and Dell and startups and nonprofits. And 90% of them report wasting 10 hours a week saying yes when they could say no, hiding a weakness or avoiding difficult conversations. Mm-hmm. And so you can sit there and say, I need an MBA to be more successful. But my experience was, I don't have a college degree and I'm not diminishing the value of one. But you could also go into a 12-step meeting and for a crappy cup of coffee and a 1 hour of your time, you could actually learn a skill that wins you back 25% of your time that can make you a lot more productive. But the problem is, and this is just like what I say in my book, is I think we've misdiagnosed the problem. I think it's not hard to bump into books on how to say no and how to be vulnerable and how to have difficult conversations, but we keep treating the symptoms. The real problem is that professionals and leaders are addicted to these behaviors. And the reason I'm so passionate about the professional space is what I found in recovery was we talked about how this will help you personally. I think learning how to not do these three things, learning how to overcome addiction becomes a professional superpower that is not well advertised to the addict community. And so most people go, oh, well, you've got to overcome addiction in order to be successful. And I'm like, well, I'm successful because of my addiction. I'm successful because of my recovery. And it's because it actually treated the problem. I'm addicted to hiding my true self, first with the drugs and then my saying yes and all that other kind of stuff. By leveraging my recovery in the professional setting, I was able to be more successful because I was more efficient, all that kind of stuff. And so now what I do is I literally help leaders get to the source of the problem. And I say, the reason that you took that workshop on how to say no and you're still saying yes, the reason you saw that TED talk got all inspired and you're still avoiding difficult conversations is because your actual problem is you're addicted to wearing a mask. You are addicted to hiding yourself. And what I know about addicts is you can tell us all the information in the world. How did the DARE program work out? It didn't work out real well for me. They told me not to use drugs. They told me drugs are bad and I still ended up an addict. Knowledge is not power. Action is power. And recovery from addiction teaches you how to turn that knowledge into action.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique 2-in-1 product combines the power of 2 clinically studied ingredients in 1 revolutionary formula: berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just 2 capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. Right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com. The lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Let's start with a story that you have that is very similar to a story I have. And you describe you're relatively newly sober.
Yeah.
You go into a halfway house and they're like, you have to go get a job. So you get an interview for a job. But the problem is, like anybody who's been in recovery for a while, you got some big gaps in your resume. Or anybody who's been, in active addiction, your resume doesn't look real good. So you walk into the meeting, you got a choice about what you're going to say. Tell us a little more about that.
Yeah. So when I got into the halfway house, they're really serious about making sure you're serious about recovery. So they gave you 5 business days to get a job or you get kicked out. I didn't even know what a business day was. Someone had to let me know because I was an addict. That's not like I did not understand business culture. And if you had asked me what a P&L is, I would have no idea what that is. So they said 5 business days to get a job. I've got this huge gap on my resume, and I'm not being honest because what I would say is for the last 3 years, all I did was get high. And I don't think that that's like going to get me a job. So I call around, I interview at all these places, and I get no job interviews. And then one place calls me for an interview on day 4, and it's this place called Sam Goody. And I always say, like, if you're older than me, you know that is a record store. If you're my age, you know it's as a CD store. And if you're less than 30 years old, you have no idea what I'm talking about.
Yep.
It's Spotify, right? So I call my sponsor before the interview. And I'm like, okay, so what do I tell them when they ask me about my job history? Because I have a huge gap. It's not going to qualify me for the job. And I expect him to tell me a way to kind of like dance around it and, be able to convince them that I'm worthy of the job. And he says, Mike, just tell them the truth. And, one of the things I've done is I've distilled down what I learned in recovery into 3 principles. And so the first one is practice rigorous authenticity, not just be authentic in a buzzy way all the time. So he was like, no matter how big the stakes, no matter how small the stakes, you tell them the truth. And I was like, okay, well, Chuck, if I tell them the truth, I'm not going to get the job. This job manages the cash register. I'm pretty sure saying that I used all day and I just got out of rehab isn't going to qualify me for that. And then I'm going to be out on the street and I'm going to end up using again and I'm going to die. What do I actually say? And he said, well, so then you have to learn how to surrender the outcome. So it's like principle 2. Surrendering the outcome, he said, this isn't about the job. This isn't about the halfway house. This is about whether you're willing to practice these principles in all your affairs. And so I'm like, well, so then what do I actually do? And so it gets to the third principle that I teach. Do uncomfortable work. Do what nobody else would do. Go in there and tell them the truth. I was scared to death. And the only reason that I followed his suggestion was because the only thing I was scared of more than not getting that job was relapse. And so I walked in. We're in the job interview. I'm starting to sweat. My heart's racing because I'm scared we're going to get to the work history thing. I'm still got like the devils on my shoulder and the angel on the other side. What do you say? And I start doing what addicts do. And I start thinking about how I can con him. Oh, I can tell him that I was like, writing a book. I could tell him that I was helping needy children, right? I could tell him all these things about this work history. And then I just think about those 3 principles: practice rigorous authenticity, surrender the outcome, do uncomfortable work. And I did something that I've never done before. And I did the uncomfortable work. And I told him exactly the truth. I said, I just got out of rehab. I've been using for the last 3 years and I'm in a halfway house. And if I don't get this job, I'll be out on the street. And at the end of the job interview, he looked at me and he smiled and he said, when can you start? And I still get emotional when I think about that story, because I really think my whole life would have been different if he had said, you don't get the job and you're out on the street, because it would have given me a conflict that I had to reconcile. But I feel like it was just so perfect, because not only did I see that my recovery could be prioritized and I could surrender an outcome and still be successful, but for my luck, it was the first battleground for my program, and it was in a professional setting, which I think really set the tone for everything I've been doing since. I never would have known that interviewing for a job at Sam Goody would have meant so much to me. I'd still be telling this story at a time when nobody knows who Sam Goody is. But I was fortunate enough to have a sponsor that said, what's true in God's world anywhere is true everywhere. And regardless of your definition of God, it was something that really helped me. And I was an atheist at the time, and I learned to surrender the outcome, and it changed my life.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. I have one that's almost identical. I was just out of a halfway house, as in I had gotten out of one. It was one that you didn't work in. So it was maybe some like a three-quarter house or something. I don't know. But I had identified this job I wanted. It was with a company called CompuServe.
Yeah.
CompuServe was one of the first online companies. I had no idea what I was getting into. I just knew like they paid really well, and there was a gym I could do, and it wasn't a restaurant. And I was desperate to not go back into the restaurant business, just because that was so tied to my partying. And same thing, get in there and they're like, well, what's with your job history and why are you qualified for this job? And I just was like, well, I just got out of a halfway house. I'm a heroin addict, but I'm working this program of recovery and I'm willing to work really, really hard for you. You know, I just told them the truth and got hired, and that launched my entire technology career.
You and I, we know tons of people that have a story like this, right? I've got a friend that applied to 4 different graduate programs. And in the first application, he lied about his recovery story and his gap and why he got kicked out of college when he was younger. And then he talked to his sponsor and he was honest on the other 3. Guess which one he didn't get into and guess which ones he got into. He got into all the ones where he was honest about it.
Right.
So the reason I'm so passionate about like the message in my book, the message I carry in general, is not everybody's an addict, but everybody can relate to being in that job interview and not wanting to volunteer the worst thing about them.
Right.
Everybody can relate to that struggle. And I don't mean just like, hey, you're not that great at Microsoft Excel. I mean, the worst thing about you, I'm a freaking drug addict, dude. Like, that's the worst thing. And so if everybody can relate to that pit in their stomach of that gap in their resume, that the weakness, whatever the personal limitations they have, I want them to know that we, you and I and others like us, are collecting thousands, if not millions of stories of people that go in there and prove that you can take the mask off, that you can be yourself and you can still be successful. Because if a drug addict can own their story in a job interview and be successful, there's nothing that anyone else that has something that's holding them back can't do. We just happen to have a more catchy story and more dramatic example. But everybody can relate to that pit in the stomach that I had in that interview. But most people don't have the same incentive that I had. I, like you, I was walking around with a loaded gun pointed at my head that said, you have to practice these principles in all your affairs or you die. And like I heard on one of your other podcasts and the things that you talk about, I had other people that believed in these principles. You talk in your TED talk about if you have 6 people that are committed to the same thing, you have 40% greater chance of success. When you go into a 12-step meeting and you hang out with a bunch of the other recovering addicts that value living by surrendering the outcome, suddenly you can be the different person that goes into a job interview and you're really real. And I will tell you, as since I've become an employer, since I became a CEO and run multiple companies, in my job interviews, I have developed tactics to try to get to a place where I can find out if you have the capacity to do what I did, because I'm more likely to want an employee that can be honest about their weaknesses and their challenges and their failures, because then I trust that they'll be able to grow the same way that I did. And if they try to like front and wear that mask in the interview, I don't trust them no matter how good they are.
Yep. So let's talk about the program in a little bit more detail. You've sort of mentioned the 3, I don't know if you'd call them pillars or steps, but practice rigorous authenticity, surrender the outcome, and do the uncomfortable work. But first, before we go into each of those in a little more detail, let's talk about the different types of masks that people wear. You've identified 4 common ones, and you've sort of touched on them here a little bit, but let's sort of call them out. These are the 4 common masks that people wear.
Yeah, when I developed the mask assessment, I started off with like 50 of them, with my hypothesis. True addict. It was a black or white. It was going to be none or a lot. And as I administered it and I started to get feedback and see the trends in the data, I started to see that they all had a common trend. And so the four masks are saying yes when you could say no, hiding a weakness, avoiding difficult conversations, and holding back your unique perspective. And so all four of these masks have a different cost for you as an individual and different cost for an organization, but they're all driven by essentially the fear of what other people will think. And it's all driven by the inability to surrender the outcome. So when you want to say no to the meeting or the project or the task or whatever, you're worried what your boss will think, your team will think. It's hard to surrender the outcome, how to overcome that fear. And that's what an addict is taught to do working in a 12-step program. When you think, just like I did, that if you get found out for not knowing how to do something, you say, I don't know. People are going to think less of you. They'll trust you less, all that kind of stuff. So you hide weaknesses. I think difficult conversations are really hard because they mean you can get kicked out of the tribe. And so as a result, the two most common forms of this that we see is performance management, people not giving people constructive criticism that can help them grow, and then customer negotiations. And then holding back your unique perspective is kind of like the cherry on top, because that's where all innovation happens and all blind spots get checked. And we see with organizations that you'll have like 50 people in the room and the executive assistant might be able to identify a blind spot or identify an opportunity for innovation, but you don't get access to it because they only want to hear the CEO and they're scared of what they're going to say. So they hide their mask. In my company, I had 50 people. We had this thing called the idea graveyard, and all of the bad ideas that lived in that graveyard were mine. And that was a way to be symbolic, to create psychological safety for all my team. Be like, I want your ideas truly. I want your unique perspective truly. I want 50 unique perspectives, not one or two or three. And I think that right now, professionals not only, we see people that are wearing these masks in their personal life and their professional life as managers, as CEOs, as direct reports. And like I said, it costs them about 500 hours a year. It's more pervasive than addiction to alcohol, drugs, sex, and gambling all combined.
Yeah. And I certainly think even years of recovery, these things are really hard. I think I ended up finding them harder in certain personal situations than in work situations. But even within work situations, as I'm hearing you talk and I'm reviewing my history, I'd like to think, well, yeah, I always had my mask off. No, I didn't.
Yeah.
You know, no. I mean, there were plenty of times that I did this. Like, I think about like avoiding difficult conversations. Like, my hardest difficult conversations were with people I managed.
Yeah.
And having the courage to tell them they weren't doing well.
Yeah.
That was my Achilles heel. And it took me a while, because for a while I thought, well, I just don't want to do it because I don't want to be mean. I want to be nice. Until I finally realized, like, I'm not being kind. I'm being scared.
Yes.
It's not helping them. It's hurting them in the long run. I mean, that was one that took me a lot of my career to really get better at. And I still feel like it was probably the area I was weakest.
So what we do with the Mastery Program is we take the power of the 12 steps and how it helps you address addiction. And we turn it into these really simple things that we call an action card that allows anyone, addict or not, to really apply the power of the 12 steps to specific practical situations like what you just talked about. So for example, we have in our program a dude that is going to be a new father, and he wanted to take 3 months of paternity leave in a company that doesn't necessarily respect that. And so he knows he's going to be tempted to say yes when he could say no on paternity leave, right? He knows people are going to ask him for help. They're going to want to check in on the plan. They're going to want to do all these kinds of things. It's already happened. And so he had to apply these principles. Practicing rigorous authenticity means identifying the mask that he wants to wear. He wants to say yes when he could say no, but what he really wants to be is present with his new daughter and his wife. That's what he really wants to be. So surrender the outcome. He has to surrender the fear of what everybody's going to think and what's going to happen to his job if he prioritizes his family. And then the uncomfortable work is he had to actually create a paternity plan that declared, I will be zero available. Not, I might be available a little bit here or there. I'll be zero available, and then go over it with his manager, fearful of what his manager would say, right? And so we've got stories of this, like what you just said, a CEO that was good at giving performance feedback to his direct reports, but terrible at their direct reports because it was awkward because they weren't directly managed by him, but he wanted to give him constructive criticism. And so he said that literally his stress level was at an 8 and he was carrying their work and it would be at a 3. If he could just get over that fear. And this is a CEO of a $65 million company, right? We have a new employee that started a job and didn't want to say, I don't know, and they're inhibiting their ramp. So they used one of these action cards on the mask of hiding a weakness, And they were able to declare, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. And they were able to be more successful. We got someone that was a corporate executive that quit to become an entrepreneur. And she had to work the mask of my unique perspective because she was on the corporate track to be successful. And she decided to do her own thing. But then we also had an entrepreneur that quit their business venture and joined a corporate job because they were hiding a weakness that they were not a successful entrepreneur. The point is that everybody's like hiding themselves behind one of these masks on a regular basis. And what we try to do is take kind of the self-help, personal help, even professional development that's fuzzy and apply it to these really concrete situations that everybody can relate to, where you have this tremendous fear, and empower them to overcome that fear and do the uncomfortable work as if their life depended on it, the same way that we learn in recovery.
Let's just take difficult conversations. So I'm avoiding a difficult conversation, whether it be with an employee works for me that is not doing a great job, or I was in a marriage for years where I avoided nearly every I avoided a lot of difficult conversations, you know? And what I was doing by that was, as you've eloquently laid out, I was trying to control the outcome completely.
Yep.
I work with a lot of people in a coaching program. I'm sure that 60% of the hands in the audience are shooting up right now going, that's me. I'm avoiding difficult conversations. So what are some practical ways we can work through that?
The first thing is getting really clear on who you're avoiding them with. A lot of times people will generalize, but it's the fear of what another person thinks that puts the mask on our face. That fear is the glue. And so you have to be really clear on who you're scared of. We're avoiding difficult conversations everywhere, but the one that really gives you the zing in the stomach, the one that gives you the most cost is, let's just say, for example, it is the wife. Let's just say, since you brought that up, right? I actually had a CEO of a company that was avoiding difficult conversations with his wife, and they were estranged, and it was costing him his marriage, right? And so the first thing that we do is we say, okay, so the way that you practice rigorous authenticity is you get really real about, hey, I'm avoiding a difficult conversation. Here's who it with, and here's what it's costing me. So traditional, just like inventory stuff. So surrendering the outcome is where everybody gets messed up. And so this is the pivotal principle. So a really practical tool for anyone listening right now is take out a piece of paper and just literally draw a line down the middle and put can't control in the top left and can control in the top right. And so when we surrender the outcome, most people intellectually understand, yeah, I need to let that go. Oh, I can't control if the customer buys. I can't control if the wife loves me. I can't control if she stays. We intellectually get this. Up until 25 years ago, knowledge was power. We're in information overload. Knowledge is no longer power. Action is. In recovery, we say action over insight. And so the problem is, how do you take that knowing and actually turn it into action? And so the way that we teach people is really simple. And you have to engage literally your body in doing this work. You take that piece of paper, and on the can't control column, you write down three things that you can't control related to this person. I can't control the wife, how she responds to what I say. I can't control what she does next. And I can't control that I feel a way that she may not like, right? You write those things down. I can't control these things. Then in the can't control column, you say, what can I control? And here's a tip. The can't control column is all about the other person. The can't control column is all about you. So I can control whether or not I'm honest with my wife. I can control how I communicate with her. So there are ways that I can communicate that are going to be more effective. And I can control when I communicate with her. Like if she's really pissed off about something, maybe that's not the right time to bring up a difficult conversation, right? So there are all these things you can't control. And so people, when they start going through this exercise, they go, oh, wait a second, I've just like a pair of binoculars gotten a little bit more clear on what the variables are here. But then we're not done. I say, go through that piece of paper. And now what I want you to do is I want you to stare at each can't control and then exit out. And literally with a pen, you have to engage your body to do it, exit out. And you do that for all three can't controls. And as you do that, you will start to all of a sudden release the outcome a little bit. And then you go down the can control column and you circle each one. And as you do that, you're literally engaging your body in getting your brain to unclench on the outcome, redirect all that energy on the things that you can't control, and double down on the things that you can. And when they're done with this piece of paper, and they step back, I say, look at all the can't controls. if you let one of these go, which one would give you the most emotional freedom? And it's usually not the one they think, it's their brain will answer. But I'm like, no, which one will give you the most emotional freedom? So maybe it's like, oh, well, I can't control what she thinks is like the intellectual answer. The emotional answer is I can't control how she responds because I'm scared of her response. Put a star by that one. And then in the can't control, which one of these is going to objectively make you more successful? And it's like how I communicate with her will make me more successful. Put a star next to that one. And then I have them write down again, can't control this, can't control this. So just the ones they picked. And I tell them to read it 1 minute a day. And after 20 days, they've rewired their fight or flight response. They've rewired their natural inclination to focus on what they can't control and redirect that energy to what they can control. And it actually allows them to go do this thing called uncomfortable work.
And so in that scenario, would you say wait 20 days to have that conversation? Or would that depend?
It would be arrogant for me to offer absolute advice because I'm not God, but, and you know that, but I have to do that disclaimer to feel better about myself. People, when they start doing this work, they get a sense of urgency and they feel like, oh, I got to do this right now. I got to do this right now. Depending on how important it is, I would wait. Yeah, I would wait. Now, at the same time, reading this little statement every day, it's not to say this isn't black and white, right? So it's not to say that on day 15, if a difficult conversation comes up that you don't like lean into it and have it. But what we're really trying to do is when those things come up, when fight or flight gets triggered, adrenaline pumps through our body, our field of vision narrows, and we become our lesser selves. And so if you can reprogram yourself to start to have that reflex of, okay, I can't control that. I can't control this. My wife always tells me, you underestimate everything that you learn as an addict. Literally everything is that. You learn how to go from what you can't control to what you can faster than everybody else. And so if 15 days of reading that card would be enough, I think, but you know, the more, the better. We say after 28 days, we want you to do a new card with a new thing that you're working on, but it depends on the situation. But generally speaking, I would say you'd want to wait 15 to 20 days if you could.
And I guess the risk or the thing to watch for there is waiting until we're not afraid to do it, because that day may never come.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So that's why you lead into the next step, which is you're doing this uncomfortable work. You know, I know what I used to get into is sort of a variation on your exercise. I couldn't have put it into those terms exactly, but I would have had the gist of it in my mind. Control, yep. Can't control. I think it would have been really helpful to walk through that process. But then there's a sense that, like, I need to figure out how to not be afraid of this in order to do it. And my experience is, yes, managing the fear.
Tired of endless diets and weight loss struggles? It's time to say goodbye to frustration and hello to results. Introducing Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD, your breakthrough solution to fight stubborn body fat. Imagine burning fat, balancing glucose levels, and regulating metabolism in just 12 weeks. This unique 2-in-1 product combines the power of two clinically studied ingredients in one revolutionary formula. Berberine, which targets abdominal fat, and OEA, which curbs your appetite. With just 2 capsules a day, Smart Metabolic Burn by BrainMD can kickstart your metabolism, fight stubborn body fat, especially that pesky abdominal fat, and support your weight management journey. Right now, save over 30% on Smart Metabolic Burn at GetSmartBurn.com. The lowest price anywhere. That's GetSmartBurn.com. Don't delay. Transform your life with Smart Metabolic Burn from BrainMD. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Our products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Is good. And then there still is a time that I'm uncomfortable and I need to move forward.
Yeah, that's why we don't call it comfortable work.
Right.
And so like people would be like, well, how do I get to a place where I'm fearless? I'm like, dude, I'm a public speaker for a living and I'm scared every time. The key is not to be fearless. The key is to know how to walk through the fear.
Yep.
And one of the things that helps is this can and can't control the surrendering of the outcome. And you're absolutely right. It's not waiting for when you don't have the fear or the pain. It's learning how to be comfortable with the discomfort. In my experience, though, going back to the thing that you said in your TED talk, the reason that my book calls out building this whole mastery program that has a bunch of other people that are doing the same thing is because if you have other people that value doing uncomfortable work, demonstrating how they're doing it, and you all share on a monthly basis, hey, here's where I did my uncomfortable work. You literally inverse the stigma that you have around the mask in the first place. You inverse the reward center where like, so like one of the things I told people when they're scared of like public speaking is I say, collect detractors. Your job is to get 5 or 10 detractors. Like I was doing social media posting and someone on one of my videos called me a sociopath. And I normally would have been like wanting to argue with him and be like, And then at the same time be like, well, I guess I'm a sociopath. I probably wouldn't think that I am one. So I don't really know if this is true. But I literally went back to my group that values doing uncomfortable work. And I said, hey, I got my hater. And so if you're around other people that are doing this process, which is the real magic of recovery, it's not just a process that you do by learning through a book or through a course or whatever. It's by doing it with other people in the exact same process and journey. Suddenly you get people that prize doing uncomfortable work. And then when you go into those moments, like chapter 6 of my book, I talk about how I went into a bar and I had a year and a half clean and it was an offsite for my team and everybody was drinking and I wanted a drink. If I hadn't had a society full of people that were committed to not drinking, that I had called before, that I was texting during, that I knew I would be able to call after and go to a meeting and see them later and be able to share the story, I would have wanted to be part of that group and I would have taken their value system. So your ability to do this uncomfortable work is not conditioned on you not having the fear. It's on using both this process and other people engaged in this process to be able to walk through that fear. And what we do in our mastery program is every month professionals meet. They build a little card on the biggest challenge in their life or the biggest growth opportunity, whatever mask is holding them back. They identify specific uncomfortable work. They go read the card. They go do the uncomfortable work. They come back, report, and do it again. And we see massive breakthroughs. We're just modeling the same thing that addicts do in 12-step recovery.
Right. And I love that idea of, yeah, we need to find people to do this work with. Whatever that challenge is, you know, it's one of the most valuable things about recovery is learning to ask for help.
It is. And, you know, one thing, though, that I learned is an entrepreneur, I found an organization called EO, Entrepreneurs Organization for entrepreneurs running a business of $1 million in revenue or more. And I thought it would be 12-step for CEOs. And so I went in there and we were all on the same challenge. We were all committed to meeting and sharing stuff. But what I found was everybody was using a different system for how they led themselves. Everybody had a different framework. Some were using the Enneagram personally. Others were using, you know, the entrepreneur operating system professionally. Everybody was using a slightly different language. And it's like going to a restaurant industry guy at the beginning. And it's like trying to order something and everybody in the supply chain speaking a different language. It's extremely inefficient. But I could go to downtown Columbus, actually, true story, and be the only white guy in a meeting in the middle of the projects and feel like different. And be able to feel loved and the same and go into that meeting and say, I'm Mike, I'm an addict and I'm struggling with step two. And 50 people know exactly, like not generally, they know exactly what I'm struggling with. Their experience is tuned exactly to what I need to hear. I felt more loved in that meeting than I did in corporate America, right? And so there's the efficiency of if you're with other people that are working the same system for how you lead yourself, there's an efficiency that is the same efficiency when we're all speaking English or we're all speaking a different, you know, a different language. I don't want to be just prejudiced to English, but there's an efficiency there that just allows us to be so much more successful and realize our potential.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's a really interesting idea. I got this program called Spiritual Habits. We ran a group course last summer. I don't know when it was. I think it was summer. And what we did is we took the big group and the big group separated into small groups. So we'd meet once a week as a big group and I'd sort of give the teachings. And then the small groups would meet once a week. And those groups are still meeting. And what's so interesting about it is kind of what you just said. There's this framework for talking about, all right, we're talking about this spiritual habit. We all know what we mean by it. You know, I found that I had that experience in recovery. And I also have had it, I've been a pretty serious Zen practitioner for several years. And it's been really interesting because it's just, you keep coming back to the same stories, the same language. Now, what I find interesting about that is that, at least for me, your and I's path diverged a little bit in that I'm not real active in 12-step recovery anymore. I've sort of moved away from it. And I have mixed feelings about that. I have moments I think, well, that's a mistake. But at a certain point, there were certain limitations to the language I felt like I kept getting sort of slotted into the same thing. So while I think there's a real benefit in that commonality, there's also the question of, does that at a certain point perhaps become limiting? I don't know. But I think it's an interesting question.
I think in order to have something of value, you need to give something up.
Yeah.
So there are trade-offs in everything.
I love that.
And so the more a framework creates clarity, you're going to sacrifice application and value in other ways that is worth it. And so I'm still really active in 12-step, but I also perceived a limitation, right? I had enough sponsees that would call me and be like, hey man, what do I do with this work situation? I'd be like, just practice those principles in all your affairs, dude. Did you not read the 12 step? And they'd be like, okay, Mike, that's great. But this is like a job and my boss doesn't work the program. So like, I can't be honest about my, you know, vulnerability or my challenge with them. I'm like, actually, you can. And it'll make you more successful. But you have to trust that. And what I learned was, at least for me, I was ignoring the fact that the 12 step language and framework wasn't exactly very professionally fluent. Mm-hmm. And so as much as I tried to apply the 12 step to professional situations, I lost a lot in the translation without being really intentional about making a real translation. I kept using a blunt tool for something that was very nuanced, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, you know, talking about a PowerPoint presentation, the 12 steps does not contemplate a PowerPoint presentation or Microsoft Excel pivot tables for that matter. It doesn't contemplate negotiating a raise with your boss. It doesn't contemplate the Sam Goody story that I told. So what I learned was, hey, there is a limitation here, and I'm going to take how I took this relatively blunt tool for this particular area, and I'm going to make a very direct translation. And it's a supplement that enhances someone's ability. 50% of the people in my program are recovering addicts, 50% are not. I love the fact that you saw a limitation and you decided not only to pursue higher levels of spiritual enlightenment for yourself, but also turn around and help others. And you and I both know that sometimes an addict can get lost doing that. Uh-huh. And as long as you don't get lost, which I can already tell just talking to you, you are not. As long as you're not one of the people that get untethered, it is arrogance to think that, for example, that 12 step is the only way that someone can get clean and stay clean. Like, I learned that early on when I had a sponsee that left our program for another spiritual program. I called my sponsor and I said, he's going to relapse. It's the end of the world. What am I going to do? Oh my God, he's an idiot. And he's like, do you know this thing called humility? And I'm like, what? He's like, it's pretty arrogant for you to think that you know what he needs in order to keep his program going. There's a lot more to what we do that works for other people. So you're just going to have to humble yourself and trust that there's a bigger plan. There's more than one way. And maybe he's going to get exactly what he needs. And I got humbled and I learned. And so unfortunately, as a human, as an addict, I want the world to be binary and clean and neat. And it's very, very gray.
It is very, very gray. Well, you and I are out of time, but we're going to continue talking about this. I'd like to explore this idea of working in or out of a 12-step program and some of the pros and cons. And I also want to talk about a couple other ideas that you bring up in the book. And one of them is really about how hard it is to spot our own self-deception, how hard it is to see ourselves. So we're going to talk about that and a couple of other things. We'll do that in the post-show conversation. Listeners, if you'd like access to the post-show conversation, to other great things like ad-free episodes, a special episode I do each week called Teaching Song and a Poem, and you want the pleasure of supporting the show, you can go to oneyoufeed.net/join and become a member. So thank you so much, Michael. I have really enjoyed this conversation. It's been fun.
Thanks, man.
If what you just heard was helpful to you, please consider making a monthly donation to support the One You Feed podcast. When you join our membership community with this monthly pledge, you get lots of exclusive members-only benefits. It's our way of saying thank you for your support. Now, we are so grateful for the members of our community. We wouldn't be able to do what we do without their support, and we don't take a single dollar for granted. To learn more, make a donation at any level, and become a member of the One You Feed community, go to oneyoufeed.net/join. The One You Feed podcast would like to sincerely thank our sponsors for supporting the show.